Hello and welcome to Shadow Talk, an information security, security operations and cyber threat intelligence podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest Photon research team. My name is Chris and this week I'm joined, and I'm actually in London, with my two compatriots, Stefano and Danny. How are you doing, guys?
Good to have you here, mate. Finally in the office.
I know. Can't stay away forever, right? And we're also joined by one of ReliaQuest CISOs, Rick Holland. How are you doing, Rick?
Good. I have some FOMO right now. I wish I was in Canary Wharf with y'all.
You're missing out, Rick.
We miss you, Rick. Make your way over sometime soon. So this week, we're going to dedicate the podcast to discussing the implications that have emerged from the Russia-Ukraine war, which I'm sure you're probably aware is approaching its one-year anniversary on 24 February 2023. The lead-up to this milestone has in the past week seen several developments, including US President Biden visiting Kyiv in what has been seen as the strongest show of support to Ukraine. And of course, this has coincided with ongoing financial and military support to Ukraine from the US and other allies within Europe and other countries across the globe. And on the other hand, Russian President Vladimir Putin has given a speech at a pro-war rally in Moscow, which reportedly was attended by up to 200,000 people. And in an earlier speech on the 21st of February, Mr. Putin blamed the West for starting the war in Ukraine as he suspended participation in a key nuclear treaty. So the first question I'd like to ask you three is, what was your initial thoughts at the time? It really seems kind of crazy. You know, I remember chatting to you all about this, you know, a good year ago now. But what was your thoughts back on the 24th of February of last year?
Yeah, so initially, I think disbelief. Despite the build-up and the intel reports that were being put out, I think we were having conversations where we were like, surely they're not going to invade, surely it's not going to happen. And then following that, as the months went on, I think it was disbelief on the other side about how have they failed so far? How have they not been able to take Kyiv? We saw all the convoys leading up to Kyiv and then fading away. But yeah, obviously just thinking of my friends and teachers and stuff in Ukraine, it was a pretty mad situation, really.
Yeah, for me it was about the same, just shock and disbelief at the beginning. Like, we were seeing, you know, the build up in the weeks before, so we were seeing Russia sort of showing the muscles there, but we also saw some signs that would point to different direction, like the cooperation between Russia and the US and the arrest of the rival operators in Russia, which was an unprecedented move. And we said, you know, this could be a good sign that nothing will happen in the end. Unfortunately, it wasn't the case. Unfortunately, we saw things starting to happen quite quickly. And yeah, I think we were all worried that the war didn't last long, as I think it was Moscow's intentions at the beginning.
Yeah, it seemed that way, that they, a series of intelligence failures, wasn't it, on not just the Russian side of things, that they anticipated this would be a very quick, decisive victory. But I think also in many sort of places in the West as well, we kind of anticipated the same thing. Obviously, we look back at what happened in 2014. It was relatively straightforward for the Russian forces. So I guess a number of intelligence failures there, but that was the key surprising thing that stood out to me. Rick, do you kind of have any thoughts on this? You know, what was going through your mind on the 24th of last year?
Well, one thing just to add on to that, I do think there's an intelligence failure in the West assessment of the Ukraine military and their capabilities as well. So there's always lessons to be learned from these events, the tragic events. It feels surreal that we're a year into it. I can't imagine what it feels like to be living, you know, in one of the cities and you're having to go into bomb shelters and losing power and it's cold and that sort of stuff. I guess, you know, the past several years have just been so difficult for humanity. And when this was starting to pop off, I'm like, this is, you know, we've had a pandemic. I live in Texas and the grid was down for an entire week. It's interesting perspective to think, yeah, in Texas, we lost the grid for a week. In the Ukraine, the grid's going down, you know, regularly. It's disrupted and things along those lines. So I just was thinking about, it's just, you know, what a rough 3 years it has been for the world. And this is just another example of how challenging it is. A bit surreal, I'd say.
Yeah, I can certainly go along with those thoughts. Yeah, it has been quite surreal, hasn't it? What stands out to you from a cyber threat perspective? You know, what's changed across the threat landscape as a result of the conflict?
So I think early days, things played out as expected. Large reliance on wiper malware, DDoS, defacement. But I think it's interesting to note the stuff that hasn't changed, like the Russian language cyber criminal scene, forums, ransomware, really hasn't changed that much. If I don't want to say if at all, but it's almost like there is no war going on, which I think reflects the Russia's like domestic population and their attitude towards the war. They just kind of try and ignore it and pretend it's not going on, and it's almost like out of sight, out of mind. I think the Russian language, which isn't the same as Russian as a country, but the Russian language cyber criminal community, a lot of forums have explicit rules banning the discussion of what they call politics, but it's basically expressing sentiment for war one way or another. And it does seem that platforms that have decided to pick a side haven't fared that well. So Conti, the now defunct, what was kind of the second biggest, I think that's right, the second biggest ransomware group at the time, yep. They came out and said, you know, we're supporting Russia. Very quickly, all of their, I don't know the percentage, but a significant percentage of their group was actually Ukrainian. And then they had all these internal divisions, and which ultimately led to their downfall. Mm-hmm. So I think forums have been wise to try and stay out of it and just say, look, we're not talking about it at all. You're not going to get a ban for supporting Russia, definitely, or publicly saying, yes, we want Russia to win. But the forums themselves haven't taken official position. They're just like, let's just stay out of this, business as normal as much as possible. And I mean, they're financially motivated anyway, so it is in their interest. But yeah, I think it's interesting to note the things that haven't changed as much as the things that have changed.
Yeah, you mentioned the kind of downfall of Conti. This was kind of a series of sort of operational faux pas that they sort of led to their downfall, wasn't it? You know, they were targeting, was it the Sri Lankan, not the Sri Lankan government, the Costa Rican government?
Yeah.
And then obviously what happened with the kind of Conti breaches we've spoken about in the podcast before. What do you think of, because I know we've spoken about this before, Danny, what do you think of Russia's decision to remove criminality for hackers targeting Ukraine?
I think it's a more of a propaganda thing. I don't think Russian law enforcement is going to be going after Russian or criminals who move in the ways that Russia wants them to go anyway. But I think maybe there was a bit of doubt that crept in after Russia cooperated with the West, arresting Revil members and taking down carding shops. I think it's an official endorsement, if anything. I don't know. I mean, it's just a proposal in the Duma. I think it is by the Russia's like chief of IT policy or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to become law. But
I mean, yeah. You've mentioned to me before that computer misuse kind of laws in Russia are pretty lax and very rarely enforced at the best of times anyway. So maybe this is just a continuation of that sort of thought of policy.
Yeah, there's often a discussion on forums about whether it's better to serve 30 years in a cushy or supposedly cushy US jail or serve 7 years. I think 7 years might be the maximum that you can get, maybe 7 or 11 years for essentially computer misuse, distribution of malware in Russia. But obviously jail time in Russia is probably going to be a bit harder.
I'd be looking for a third option of not doing either of those, to be perfectly honest with you. So I think it's fair to say that the reaction from cyber criminals has been in some ways varied, you know, obviously the likes of Conti, but for the most part, cyber criminals have kind of kept the head. It's not worth keep putting your head above the parapet, is it really? You know, and having that additional scrutiny from law enforcement and of course, you know, media and other, you know, entities within Russia.
Yeah, that has never paid off for cyber criminals in Russia. Like every time they've committed some high profile attacks, they think about DarkSide attacking the mm-hmm. Colonial Pipeline or Conti just pleading their allegiance to Russia. It never ended well for them. While on the other hand, groups that have managed to keep their public footprint smaller have managed to thrive, like Lockbit, for example.
I was just going to say Lockbit, even though they are by far and away the outlier in terms of ransomware activity, definitely. They still have this kind of odd ability to keep their heads below the water, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's sort of like most active. Learning the rules, you know, don't attack CNI, don't attack governments, don't get too involved in politics, and you'll have probably a longer life on the cyber criminal ecosystem that you would normally do otherwise. So I'm pretty sure that Lockbit will eventually have problems with law enforcement because, as you said, like they are that prominent, like in terms of the pyramid of cybercrime right now. But, you know, they can buy ourselves some time, but just not do this kind of stuff.
Maybe they should stop requesting their members get tattoos of Lockbit, though. That's probably not a sensible step, I would say.
That would help.
Rick, have you got any thoughts on kind of cyber criminals and the way it's been influenced by the conflict at all?
This is the only thing I would add on is you think the Hive disruption from a month ago, something along those lines. I mean, we had a blitz of ransomware the very next week occurring. And with respect to Lockbit in particular, I'm sure there's global law enforcement activities right now. These cases take time to build out and then they make their move at the right time. So I'm quite certain given the prominence of Lockbit that there's things in flight there. And this might pivot a little bit. You know, I'm glad that we led with cybercrime because I think for a lot of organizations, cybercrime is probably the most, you know, significant thing in their threat model that's out there. But obviously in this conflict, I know we're going to talk a little bit about the nation state angle, or I hate the word nation state, but affiliated, directed, you know, that sort of stuff there. But for most organizations, cybercrime is going to have more impact on people associated with the Russian government targeting your organization, unless they're the moonlighting criminals, right? Which we know people moonlight there. But like, as far as Sandworm targeting the world, less likely to occur in your threat model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have you guys got any thoughts on kind of the, what we've seen in this conflict in terms of, again, the word that Rick used there, we all hate, but state associated, state aligned threat groups targeting Ukraine. I think the kind of thought process that a lot of us have had during this conflict is, oh, well, there hasn't been much nation state aligned activity targeting Ukraine, but that probably isn't actually accurate. Maybe it's just not been as effective as we originally anticipated.
I think Rick made the point earlier of, so when lots of people have thought, oh, how have Russia, you know, we overestimated their strength. I think, yeah, like Rick said, people massively underestimated Ukraine's strength. And we were talking about earlier in the preparation for this, like the ground campaign is very much Russia versus Ukraine. There's no US troops stationed like fighting Russians at the moment, but the cybersphere is totally different. It's not Russia versus Ukraine, it's Russia versus Ukraine plus NATO plus others. Yeah,
absolutely. It's a very different sphere of conflict, isn't it, really? I know one of the questions I was going to ask is kind of that attribution for threat groups and the way we kind of traditionally look at cyber threats, you know, pigeonholing them into certain groups. Has that become more difficult in the context of the war? I would say it has. I'm kind of thinking to some of the examples like Free Civilian, you know, masquerading as supposed cyber criminals, wipers disguised as ransomware, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think Free Civilian's an interesting one because they were very quick to respond, kind of suspiciously quick, really. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, it does seem like they are at least in some way connected with the Russian intelligence services. They were very quick. They must have known what was going to happen in advance. Again, people talk about why Russia has seemingly failed in Ukraine is because up until the day of the invasion, lots of commanders, even at a senior level, didn't know that there was going to be an invasion. But there's definitely involvement. We did investigation into Yanluo Wang ransomware group. One of their members was, or three of their members were doxxed, and one of them turns out to be a member of the Russian ground forces. Again, we don't know if he's acting in an official capacity or he's just moonlighting as it as a ransomware affiliate. But there's definitely, yeah, I think most people listening to this as well would know that there is some collusion at some level between ransomware groups and the Russian government.
It probably comes back to that piece that I always use an example, Rick, the Atlantic Council one you shared.
Actually just brought it up on my second screen again because I really love this.
It is useful. Yeah. Do you want to give a quick explanation, if you've got it open, of kind of what they outlined?
Yeah. So the Atlantic Council is a American think tank, and Jason Healy is one of the folks there, and he wrote this piece called Beyond Attribution, Seeking National Responsibility for Cyber Attacks. But what I like in it is, instead of simplifying things and saying nation state, he actually breaks out 10 different categories of how actors could be working affiliated or not affiliated with the state. So, you know, it goes state prohibited. I won't read through them all, but ones that kind of stand out to me, they're state encouraged. Third parties control and conduct the attack, but the national government encourages them as a matter of policy. There's also state shaped, state coordinated, state ordered. And then, of course, you got state executed and state integrated. So there are 10 levels there, but it does, you know, we often say nation state, but that just oversimplifies it, in particular in the Russian scene as well, maybe more so than in some of the other scenes that are out there. So, yeah, that's a really good one. We can put that in the show notes for folks that are looking for probably a more sophisticated way to assess what a state's role is in cyber operations.
Yeah, I guess the example we were giving of Russia changing policy to allow cyber criminals to target Ukraine, that would probably be an example of state endorsed, right? That's what they're doing as a matter of national policy, as you just alluded to. And I think the key here is just for analysts who are listening, just not to overly compartmentalize these sort of threats and just kind of remain flexible when you're thinking of them. And I've definitely been guilty of that in the past. You know, which one of those three is it? Those three convenient boxes does it kind of fit into? Thinking of the sort of traditional three ways we assess threats, how has the resurgence of hacktivism been influenced by the conflict?
I think that's been like the most interesting development in terms of cyber threat landscape from the Russia-Ukraine war. Because, maybe the state-sponsored activity wasn't as prominent as we were thinking or preparing for. Cybercrime has changed, but like in terms of effects, it didn't incredibly affect the way it's been conducted. But hacktivism really has changed the fact what we're observing right now. So at the beginning of the war, like the weeks before the war, we hadn't seen a lot of hactivism really for the past years, really since 2017 or something. But after the beginning of the war, we see different groups emerge. We've seen Killnet, Chaknet from Russia, like pro-Russian activist groups. We've seen Ukrainian activist groups emerge as well. And it's been really interesting to see how these groups started from being, you know, crowdsourced and like not really well-organized groups to become proper groups right now, threat groups that maintain a significant state of threat for various organizations. When we're talking about what businesses should be more interested in when talking about cyber threat landscape and Russia-Ukraine, hacktivism is probably the one that may affect them the most in terms of likelihood and not impact, that would be cybercrime, mm-hmm. but in terms of likelihood and business continuity downtime, DDoS, the phasing attacks, all these sort of TTPs traditionally associated with activist groups would be the priority, I'd say.
We actually changed our threat assessment on Killnet and raised them up a severity level around the time, 3 weeks ago when they were targeting U.S. hospitals. But Killnet in particular, they went after, I travel so much, I'm keenly aware of this, but they went after the a lot of U.S. airport websites, and people kind of mocked and said this is a minimal impact and things along those lines. And then they've gone after the hospitals. But what I will say is, if you become a victim of Killnet, you're not going to think they're a nuisance threat that's out there. I think we all have to be careful when we think about hacktivists to think, oh yeah, they're just hacktivists, they don't have capability. Killnet has the ability to take down websites, and if your website isn't properly secured, that could have significant implications for the IT and security teams and the business as a whole. So I don't think we should minimize, oh, they're just hacktivists, they're very down low on our threat model. Fortunately, Killnet has kind of switched their targeting back to Europe, Sweden, Denmark, some of the recent ones in their list. But they're up, Killnet's doing new target lists seemingly a couple times a week right now, just over the past 3 or 4 weeks. So I would definitely be tracking Killnet to see if they start to target other, you know, Western industries and verticals.
Yeah, I mean, any outage of any kind, particularly a sensitive target like a hospital, can be absolutely impactful. You know, it literally can cause a threat to life. So, yeah, maybe that's a way we need to rethink going forward is not just go, oh, like you say, like they're just hacktivists, a few DDoS attacks here and there. We've got a good third-party DDoS provider, we'll be fine. You know, they can absolutely cause an impactful attack. So, I mean, that's the way I've thought of DDoS in the past. I've gone, oh, well, it's usually just a distraction while they're doing something worse in the background.
Yeah, you know? We've seen it as part of, like, the triple extortion in ransomware or something like that.
Mm.
But Killnet in particular are a good group to follow because a lot of what they do is, a lot of what they say, the communications they put out, is actionable. So particularly they work with Anonymous Sudan, who may or not actually be from Sudan.
Yeah.
They're now an official member of Killnet. But frequently Anonymous Sudan will say, you know, we're going to attack the Swedish aerospace industry tomorrow or the day after. And then they do it. So a lot of times, particularly on cybercriminal forums, you don't see people announcing a target. There's not much you can, you know, you just have to have good security posture in general. But if Killnet are putting out these communications about what they're going to do, that's good to follow. There's things you can do about that. I don't know in terms of time frame, but one other thing that we were talking about hacktivism earlier, particularly DDoS. So DDoS has a low barrier to entry. It's much easier to engage in a DDoS attack than conduct a ransomware attack, for example, from start to finish. But we thought there's going to be some long-reaching effects, and DDoS and hacktivism is kind of like a gateway to other areas of cybercrime. Like, this war will end at some point. People who've learned, you know, if you think about all the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians who in the past year have learned to shoot, you know, fire weapons, that's going to be a hard skill to monetize after the war ends. But if you didn't know how to conduct a DDoS attack prior to the war, and now you do, when the war ends, you could still monetize those skills or pivot to another area of cybercrime. We think it'll have quite a long-lasting effect because Killnet does have quite a lot of members. There's loads of other activist groups that'll have people who did not know how to conduct cybercrime before the war who now do.
I mean, that brings me on nicely to another sort of question is, how do you anticipate the war will influence the cyber threats facing, you know, many of the companies that our listeners will be working for? So you just mentioned their possibility for an increased number of people getting involved in cybercrime because they've developed these skills throughout this conflict. Could you see the possibility of, say, I don't know, hacktivists getting their hands on commodity malware, ransomware, things of that nature, using that as part of their attack?
Oh, yeah, well, I just want to say that it's probable that's going to happen, especially like considering the end of the war. Like, we don't know how the war is going to end, of course. We don't know when the war is going to end. But usually after something like that, the economic conditions of a country are not excellent. And cybercrime in those situations thrive, like any kind of criminal activity thrive in those kind of situations. So if, as Danny was saying, if cyber criminals or like internet users have learned a set of skills that can be monetized and you find yourself being in a bad economic situation, you may think about reusing them, readapting them. And so if you've been doing DDoS for like 1 year during the war, 2 years or whatever, you may think about, you know, reusing those skills, readapting them to new malware, to maybe moving, pivoting to ransomware, because that's like a definitely profitable economic business from a cyber criminal point of view. So yeah, I definitely wouldn't exclude that.
I mean, the infrastructure is already in place. If you want to learn more skills.
And the networking too.
Yeah. I mean, forums they keep growing, especially the two biggest ones, XSS, Xploit, they're still growing. If you want to learn a new offensive skill, buy a new piece of tooling, malware, whatever, it's there. So I would say it's very likely that, yeah, as Steph mentioned, the economic conditions will serve as a push factor. Cyber criminals who've dabbled in a bit of DDoS, hacktivism, it's not going to take them much to cross over into financially motivated crime.
There's one angle that I wanted to talk about, and I've mentioned this probably on the early days of podcasts that we covered as well, just with respect to Russia and the cyber impact of the war. You've had a lot of people that have minimized, you know, the cyber implications. I think KillNet's a good example of how it's extended. But the thing that I said last year was we didn't know about SolarWinds until we knew about SolarWinds. There could be activities that are being undertaken right now that are not public. In fact, just yesterday, we're recording this on the 23rd, but Dutch intelligence released a poor. First of all, I love the Dutch law enforcement and well as intelligence agencies. I mean, they've done a great job of releasing stuff on GRU, other Russian threat actors, as well as being involved in the Hansa Alpha Bay takedown from many years ago that's there. But yesterday they released a piece, and basically they were saying that there's a lot of attempts that have not become public knowledge. So a lot of Russian cyber operations that are not public knowledge now. So we don't know the full extent of what's happened in the past year. We don't know what type of capabilities. You know, there's a term, you know, intelligence gain loss, right? If you do some type of activity, you could be burning a capability, right? You're letting the people know that you have it. So they could be, you know, keeping the powder dry a little bit. They may have implants in organizations and then are just sitting and waiting. We just don't know. So I think it could be a fallacy to say Russian cyber operations were a complete failure. And certainly if you're a Viasat, and your satellite network got taken down in the early days of the conflict, you would not agree with that. So I think it's largely been regional. KillNet has made it more global, but there's a lot of stuff underneath the surface, you know, the iceberg analogy, right? You know, there's a lot of things below the waterline that we may not be seeing right now.
I also think that it's important to just put on the table and discuss the fact that there's been a lot of like disinformation and influence operations going on before, during, and eventually after the war, from Russia, but also like from Western actors. Because like usually when we talk about cyber threat intelligence, we're focusing on server networks, like all this kind of stuff, more technical operations. But the impact that this information warfare can have in a conflict like that one is pretty big, and I don't think it should be underestimated. And that's also something that Russian intelligence services have been doing for a long time at a foreign level, like, for example, during the 2016 U.S. elections. And since then, it's just grew bigger and bigger. Yeah. If we see everything that happens on social media, too, that's constant. And that has a big impact on what happens every day, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to say on disinformation. I mean, there was examples at the start of the conflict, wasn't there, using deep fakes of Zelensky.
Yeah.
You know, what was he saying? Put your arms down. You know, we've agreed to surrender or something along those lines. And I have to say, I've seen a few of these AI generated deep fake videos that have emerged in the last 6 months, say. And I can see they're fake, right? I can see that fake. But I work in this industry, so I'm naturally quite curious. But if you're a regular person, you're not involved in technology or cybersecurity, you could see how people would fall for that. So yeah. I think they're going to become much more commonplace, not just amidst the conflict, but wider, you know, cyber threat landscape as well.
Yeah, and right now there's like this huge hype thing with AI because of ChatGPT and everything is happening in that domain at the moment. But this information can also take much more simpler aspects, like, you know, fake websites, domain news articles that are just like slightly tweaked in order to have the reality appear a little bit different. And those things take a long time to appear. Like when you see like an AI generated video, you know, that's the document, that's the fact, last 30 seconds, that's it. But the narratives that are built in terms of the information take place in months and years, and those are more subtle and really have a greater impact, I think.
We almost did it, by the way. We almost got through a podcast without mentioning ChatGPT. Just failed. We almost did
it's the new ransomware for us. One thing I will add on related to IO, related to deepfakes, is, you know, the Russia-Ukraine war has become a proving ground, a testing ground, essentially with the West and Russia. So that's happening from a cyber perspective. Certainly you're seeing it from a drone perspective and a lot of innovation that's happening there. So there will be a lot of lessons that come out from this conflict that inform future conflicts, future cyber operations, kinetic operations, probably a lot of lessons learned. And we've done research in the past on China and Taiwan as well. And you got to believe that if something like this occurs there, there's lessons learned from this playbook that will be taken into account in the future.
Absolutely. We're coming up to about, I think, 35, 40 minutes now. I'll just end with this final question I'd like to pose to all three of you. What do listeners need to do to minimize the risk or improve their resilience to many of the threats that will actually surface in relation to this conflict? So obviously we've gone through a lot, but what do listeners need to actually do? What's the takeaway here?
Am I boring if I say...
Well, you got the echo.
Yeah. I'm going again. Am I boring if I say just cover the usual basics, the stuff we always talk about, the basic cyber hygiene methods? So, yeah, in terms of activism, we've seen a lot of defacement attacks, DDoS, like sort of disruptions, attacks that can be sort of mitigated quite easily when following those measures. Cybercrime is a bit more complex, but still covering the basics, as we often say, will get you like more difficult, because like these actors are mainly opportunistic and from state sponsored, really difficult to protect. But again, do the basics and you will be in a better position. I think in terms of this war specifically, it's just another reminder of the importance of having a sort of service or like monitoring of geopolitics and cyber intelligence, so sort of a broader strategic view of what's happening out there. An example that I wanted to make that I was mentioning to Danny before is that in the past few days, the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni went to Ukraine to see Zelensky, and likely as a result of that, several Italian organizations, public and private, were hit by defacement attacks, DDoS attacks. So knowing what's happening out there beyond your organization, beyond the perimeter of your defenses, has always been really important. And this war, I think, just proved another time how this sort of services can really impact you, can really help you prevent and mitigate any sort of threats from physical to cyber.
So be aware of the kind of drivers outside of your own organization that may increase the risk, in this case being the Italian Prime Minister.
Because like when you talk about defense, like you figure in your head sort of like this perimeter, this sort of castle where you want to close yourself within, right? Yeah. But threats come from outside, and if you don't know what's happening out there, it's really difficult to prevent that. So I think that's one of the key lessons, I'd say, that should come from this war.
Excellent. Really good. Yeah. Any thoughts, Danny?
I would echo that. Like before the war, we're mainly thinking about financially motivated actors. It's okay, we know they're motivated by earning money, but that's not specific to one geography or one sector. With particularly hacktivism and the DDoS campaigns, like I said earlier, like in many cases, they're saying we're going to attack this sector. So yeah, I would agree with Steph that having an increased interest in geopolitics and which groups are saying we're going to do this, we're going to do that, can often help you. Even if it's just a few hours notice, at least you're braced for impact in that respect. But yeah, in regard to DDoS, just the standard hygiene rules apply. Backups, load balancers, just making sure your infrastructure is resilient. If it does happen, if you think that you're in a key target sector, just brace for impact if you hear that something might be happening.
Absolutely. And you were just saying there about, you know, spending a few hours a day just kind of keeping yourself abreast of topics. I would just say that very much, in my opinion, kind of falls on the individual analysts and kind of your CTI team. They should be informing executives, by the way, do you know this is happening? They don't have every hour in the day to go scouring every single open source and news site. So keeping your executives aware, by the way, this is coming down the line, most likely, I think is a key point to make. Rick, any thoughts from you before we close?
One, I would just support what Steph said as far as the basics. I mean, if you think of your security controls, you want to have, you know, the basics aren't easy, of course, but you want to have enough a resilience to protect against 80% of the threats. I'll just use the Pareto principle. The other 20%, you might have to have some special types of controls, monitoring third parties in place for, but 80% of your security strategy should protect, or you should be able to protect against 80% of the threats to your strategy with multi-factor authentication, patching external services, you know, risk-based prioritization, vulnerability intelligence to kind of feed that there. So I would echo what Steph said. Beyond that, practically what I would suggest that organizations do is if you haven't done a tabletop exercise on a DDoS to your organization, or a DDoS to a supply chain partner, perhaps, that might have implications for you, I would add that into your rotation for the year. I would also, if you haven't done a DDoS on Wiper, and I would say that a Wiper response is different than a ransomware response, I would add a tabletop exercise in for that. And we've talked about it in the podcast before, doing kind of a two-parter, one that's a tactical one that's got your blue team, red teams in the mix, but then also having an executive component where you're talking about some of the bigger picture things. Let's say you do get taken down by Killnet. How are you going to announce that? You know, how are you going to respond to the media, to your customers, your third parties that you use, that sort of thing. So I think two big takeaways for me is look at the threats that are happening in this war, run a tabletop exercise, come up with a plan. What I love about tabletops is they just require time. Right. You know, the tabletops can inform your future investment decisions. But it's not, you know, it's not like, oh my God, Killnet's coming after us, we need to go buy a DDoS scrubbing service in the cloud. No, you run a tabletop exercise and you can evaluate to see if your on-prem equipment is strong enough to handle it. And if it's not, then you go with an Akamai or an F5 or some of the companies that have the cloud services if you need to scale there. So for me, it's all about the tabletop exercise.
Excellent. Yeah, I suppose there's only one way to kind of test your resilience, really, and that's kind of in a live scenario. And this is as close to a live scenario as you're going to get. So, yeah, really good advice there. Okay, well, we'll end there. Thank you to all three of you for contributing today. Really, really interesting discussion. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to our listeners as well. We'll be back next week at the same time. Other than that, stay safe, and we'll see you soon.